This is Robert Silver, editor of the New York Review of Books. You're listening to a New York Review podcast.
This is Chris Carroll with the New York Review. Recently, I spoke with Jeffrey O'Brien, the editor-in-chief of the Library of America, whose review of Harvey Cohen's book, Duke Ellington's America, appeared in the October 28th issue of the New York Review. We spoke about the crisis of Duke Ellington's middle career, his suite, Black, Brown, and Beige, and some of the often overlooked albums of Ellington's later career. Well, hi, Jeffrey. Thanks for talking with me today.
Hi, Chris.
People tend to know Duke Ellington for his work from the 1930s and the early 40s, songs like Take the A-Train and Mood Indigo. But I think there's this unfortunate tendency to overlook the later part of his career, which, as you note in your piece, really contains some of his most original and fascinating albums. So I wondered if you might talk a bit about just what's so remarkable about this later period, which begins with what Harvey Cohen calls in his book Ellington's commercial and aesthetic nadir in the mid-1950s.
I think it's almost a convention when people talk about Ellington's career to take that moment as this great crisis. I think partly because he was under contract to Capitol, which was seen as commercially a great thing, and he notably failed to come up with a real hit, although he did release Satin Doll for Capitol, which ultimately became a standard. And you can hear in a lot of the records he was making then that he was very deliberately trying to concoct a hit record, obviously out of the frustration of no longer being able to command the kind of audiences and venues that he'd enjoyed, you know, in the previous decade while the big band phenomenon was ruling popular music. So, yeah, he was in a very vulnerable position. He was trying to sustain his orchestra, something which had become increasingly expensive, and There was a crisis, and what resolves it to some extent is the unexpected smash of his performance at the 1956 Newport Jazz Festival, where Paul Gonsalves launches into this incredible multi-chorus solo on diminuendo and crescendo in blue and rocks the house. Everybody goes crazy, and suddenly Duke Ellington is seen as this up-to-the-minute guy, and he's on the cover of Time, and the album becomes a bestseller. This was the kind of luck that someone has who's actually at it all the time, and I'm sure that if it hadn't been that, it would have been something else, because I don't really see that much of a nadir in his music ever. I mean, yeah, there's a rocky moment there, the Capitol and Roulette period, where you can detect an uncertainty about how to proceed and an unwillingness to become an oldie act like so many of the big bands who were able to continue to make good money, but essentially peddling nostalgia. And Ellington was not interested in that ever. Even though, of course, he continued to record and to perform his old hits, but always with a difference. He's always going for a different angle, a slightly different approach. And he was also always composing new music, so he didn't want to get stuck in that thing of playing the greatest hits over and over again. So he succeeded against all odds and was able then to launch into this second wave of his career, really, which extends from the late 50s to his death. And many of those albums, I think, are magnificent and are easily among his best music.
Thank you.
I mean, I think there's been a, formerly at least, a tendency to prize the early work at the expense of the later work, partly because it is so great, and no one would ever question the work from the late 30s and the early to mid 40s. And certainly the musicians that he had in his band then, like Jimmy Blanton and Ben Webster, were unsurpassable. But the later work branches out into very ambitious directions, and he never settles down into a predictable groove. Even as has a thriving career as a live performer and is constantly traveling the country, traveling the world, and in the course of that, playing his whole book of standards, but never exclusively that. He's always filling in with the new music and releasing albums of new music. And I think that's, I don't know, it's almost without parallel, I think, the degree to which he did not stop until literally his death. I mean, he was working on new compositions in the hospital.
Could you mention a few of these later albums that you think people may have overlooked?
Probably most people are not really that aware of, for example, the Ballet Suite, The River, which is a long, late composition. The very surprising Afro-Eurasian Eclipse, which is a very percussive and aggressive suite from 1971, one of his, you know, really later pieces. The Afro Bossa suite that he recorded in 1961, which takes the kind of exotica with which he had been associated as far back as the 30s, and it just raises it to another very, very self-conscious level of workmanship. I mean, it's this kind of series of glistening pieces. I think it will bear further fruit, you know, when more musicians listen to it.
And so one of the things you notice about this sort of later period of Ellington's albums is that he tends toward longer compositions, these suites.
Well, yes. I mean, and this, of course, you know, has also been a matter of contention in some of the critical writing about Ellington. A lot of it has to do with the fate of his suite Black, Brown, and Beige, which was first performed at Carnegie Hall in, I believe, 1940, and never thereafter performed in full, never recorded in full. There are the recordings that were pieced together from the Carnegie Hall date and another date, which give us the fullest known extent of Black, Brown, and Beige. Thank you. there was a lot of criticism at the time. Many people were disappointed. And people like John Hammond and Paul Bowles made invidious comments that essentially Ellington wasn't suited for this kind of large-scale composition, and it was a great disappointment, and he should basically, you know, stick to what he does best. And since Black, Brown, and Beige was for Ellington a fantastically important work, which fused not only his musical concerns, but his concerns with black history, which are woven into it. And Harvey Cohen, in his book, performs a great service, I think, by exploring the literary side of this, the very extensive notes, poetic notes, really, that Ellington wrote as the basis for the composition, which go a lot farther, really, than many of the public statements that Ellington was making about the work, either at the time or subsequently. So, you know, having experienced that that disappointment with Black, Brown, and Beige, Ellington then continued to create these suites and always, I think, came up against a lot of criticism. And even after his death, I mean, there have been books that have made much of this point that, well, the suites really aren't suites and they're just collections of short pieces. I mean, I think there's a misunderstanding to the extent that, and again, this is something that Cohen's book, I think, clarifies, that Ellington was not interested in imitating Western classical music. This was really not his goal. He was interested in creating a new music based on his own notions of form. And so to expect something that resembles some prior model of a classical suite is really misleading. I mean, obviously, he listens to everything, and all kinds of things are woven into the music. But it's its own thing. At the same time, I think the consistency within, if you listen to Far East Suite, New Orleans Suite, the Afro Bossa album, there's a tremendous consistency within these albums, or for that matter, the soundtrack for Anatomy of a Murder, which, taken apart from the movie, is a very consistent piece of music with its own sound, a sound that's quite unique in Ellington's work.
My last question for you is just if what is your personal favorite album from this later period, if you had to pick just one?
Now that is hard. That is really very hard. I love the New Orleans Suite, which is just a fantastically energetic record. I do love the Billy Strayhorn tribute, and his mother called him Bill, which is all Strayhorn compositions recorded not long after his death. We haven't talked about Billy Strayhorn and his role in all of this, which is a matter for another, a whole other conversation. But as a tribute, by Ellington to his closest collaborator. It's really a very, very moving record. And I also love the Queen Suite. I think it's just particularly beautiful, right up to the final piano solo, the single petal of a rose.
Well, thank you very much, Jeffrey.
Thanks, Chris.
I've been speaking with Jeffrey O'Brien about Duke Ellington. The songs you heard, in the order they were sampled, were Mount Harissa from the Far East Suite, Diminuendo in Blue and Crescendo in Blue from Ellington at Newport 1956, Up and Down from Such Sweet Thunder, Ad Lib on Nippon from the Far East Suite, The Ballet Suite in the River, Octoclock Rock from the Afro-Eurasian Eclipse, Moonbow from Afro-Bossa, Come Sunday from Black, Brown, and Beige, Main Title and Anatomy of a Murder from the Soundtrack to Anatomy of a Murder, Blood Count from And His Mother Called Him Bill, Single Petal of a Rose from the Queen's Suite, and Portrait of Mahalia Jackson from the New Orleans Suite. To read The Grandest Duke and other articles by Jeffrey O'Brien that have appeared in our pages, please visit nybooks.com.